Welcome to the Brain Science Podcast, the show for everyone who has a brain. I'm your host, Dr. Ginger Campbell, and this is episode 118. Today's episode is a brief introduction to neuroanatomy, or the anatomy of the brain. It is actually an edited version of episode 32, which originally aired back in 2008. I've been getting requests to return to some of the basic topics that I covered back in the first couple of years. So I chose this episode because understanding the structure of the brain can help us to get a better handle on how it works. Obviously, the audio format is not ideal for a discussion of brain structure, but I decided to tackle it with the help of a wonderful book by David Bainbridge called Beyond the Zonules of Zen. This book is aimed at readers of all backgrounds, which makes it perfect for the equally diverse audience of the Brain Science Podcast. If you are new to the Brain Science Podcast or neuroanatomy, I hope you will focus on the big picture. Don't get stressed out trying to learn any of the strange terms I will have to throw at you. On the other hand, if you are a medical person who perhaps took neuroanatomy long ago, I hope this will be an enjoyable review. As always, you can find complete show notes and episode transcripts on our website at brainsciencepodcast.com, and you can send me feedback at brainsciencepodcast@gmail.com. I will be back at the end of the episode to provide a brief review and to tell you a little bit about upcoming episodes. Beyond the Zonules of Zen was published in January of 2008, and the zonules of Zen are the tiny fibers that connect the lenses of the eye to the muscle ring or iris. This is just one of the many weird named parts of the brain. One of the points that Bainbridge makes is that the gross anatomy of the brain was mapped out before we knew much about what the structures actually did. And in his book, he gives a lot of great stories behind the names. Now, I'm not going to be giving these stories. You're going to have to read the book for that. This is a lot of material to squash into a podcast. His deeper purpose is to share how understanding the structure of the brain helps us to understand how it works. And this is also what we want to do on the Brain Science Podcast. What we're going to do is we're going to start at the spinal cord and work our way up. Before we get more into the brain itself, there is one other thing that he says early in the book that I think is worth noting, and that is that he makes an observation about one of the key differences between brains and computers. Those of you who are regular listeners know that this is one of my sort of favorite themes. He points out something that I hadn't really thought much about, and that is the fact that computers are very vulnerable to damage. If you have one bad chip in your computer, the whole thing quits working. In contrast, the brain is designed to withstand damage. You hit your head, you have alcohol, infections, and then there's the degeneration of aging. On page 37, he says, in short, the brain is meant to be in a constant state of coping with failure. Although it may seem sad, this is one of its greatest achievements. One of the best chapters in this book is the chapter about brain development, which is called A River Runs Through It. Because understanding how the brain develops in the embryo helps us to understand why it looks the way it does. I'm going to give you a very brief overview of this. One thing I'm planning to leave out is most discussion of the cerebral spinal fluid and the ventricles, which are the spaces in the brain where the fluid flows. At about 15 days after fertilization, the embryo is a three-layered disc. We share the structure with most other animals. The layers are called the endoderm, mesoderm, and ectoderm. The brain and the spinal cord and the skin come from the top layer, the ectoderm. There's also a cord running through the mesoderm, which is called the notochord. This is important because it divides our body into symmetrical halves. It ends up forming the jelly-like discs that we have between our vertebrae. This flat disc starts curling toward the endoderm, and as it's curling toward the endoderm, there's a groove forming down the back or the top in the ectoderm. So the belly closes up in the front, while the groove in the back eventually closes over to form the neural tube. So basically, the curling up of the endoderm is going to make the GI tract, and this tube on the back, which is the neural tube, is what becomes the brain and the spinal cord. The brain is basically an outgrowth of the spinal cord, and it starts out as a series of bulges in the neural tube. These bulges eventually will form all the main structures of the brain, but understanding how it forms makes the structures make sense. And it also helps us to understand how much we have in common with other animals, especially mammals. The simplest way of looking at the brain is to consider the three main bulges, starting with the one nearest the spinal cord, which is called the hind brain. This contains the pons and the medulla. Then there's the midbrain, and finally the forebrain. The hind and midbrain make up what's known as the brainstem. The forebrain will include the cerebral hemispheres. And one of the things that happens during brain development is that some of the regions are going to grow faster than others, and this leads to a 90-degree kink in the midbrain. This is so that everything can kind of fit inside the head. And the parts of the hindbrain also have to kink up to fit. The endbrain grows out laterally from the forebrain and wraps itself around the rest of the brain. The bulge that later becomes the cerebellum arises a little bit later, but because it grows so rapidly, it ends up being much more densely packed with neurons. In the mature human brain, the endbrain, which grew out of the forebrain, and the cerebellum are the dominant structures. The basic developmental steps are the same in all vertebrates, but while in most mammals, most of the kinks straighten out, in our brain, these kinks remain. This helps everything fit in our head, but it also seems to be related to our erect posture. I have just barely touched on his excellent description of this, and I really want to refer you back to his book if you want to know the details of this, but this should at least give us a starting point so that we can take sort of a tail-to-head look at the basic anatomy of our nervous system. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about the spinal cord. Our spinal cord does less than it does in most other animals, but it has about the same basic structure. One thing that's interesting is that in the spinal cord, the gray matter, which is the neurons, is on the inside, and the white matter, or the axons, are on the outside. But if you look at a cross-section of the spinal cord, what you'll see is this gray butterfly-shaped thing, which is where the neurons are. In the middle of that, there'll be a canal, which is the spinal canal, where the cerebral spinal fluid goes. There'll be two horns on the front, which contain motor roots, and two horns on the back, which contain sensory roots. And at every level, spinal nerves are coming off that contain both sensory and motor nerves to a certain body segment. He points out that this arrangement of sensory in the back and motor in the front is a theme that continues through most of the brain. Now, the spinal cord is not just a passive conduit for information going up to and from the brain. There are spinal cord reflexes that are hardwired. One, for example, is the crossed extensor reflex. This is what happens when you step on something painful. You automatically pull up your foot, and the other leg reflexively straightens so that you don't fall over. These kinds of reflexes always involve exciting certain muscle groups and relaxing the opposing muscle groups. These reflexes are also more important in other animals than they are in humans. So that's the spinal cord. Now we're getting to the brain itself. His approach is to first talk about the sensory organ that is coming in at a particular brain area, talk about it, and talk about that area of the brain. So for the very lowest part of the brain, or the hind brain, an important sensory input at this level is what comes from the ear. So I'm going to start out by talking a little bit about the origins of the ear. This is interesting because in considering the ear, Bainbridge introduces us to some of what is known about vertebrate brain evolution. And he remarks that this is an area where there's going to be an unavoidable uncertainty, since brains don't leave fossils. However, what's different about the ear is that since it contains bones, it is possible to trace the fossil evidence for its development. Remember that the ear actually has two functions, and I'm not talking about the part that sticks out from your head. I'm talking about the organs inside, the inner ear, so to speak. Besides hearing, we have functions related to the position of the head. We commonly call this balance. Most vertebrates have three semicircular canals that are arranged at right angles. And he talks a little bit in the book about how these are arranged and how they work and how they've changed in evolutionary history. But part of detecting head motion involves detecting acceleration. There's these little stones in the fluid of the canals, and then the hair-like neurons are stimulated when the stones move around. The area where the hair-like neurons, the sensing neurons are, this area is called the macula. And at some point in evolution, this area also began to detect pressure waves of low-frequency sound. And this is probably the method that fish use for hearing. However, sound waves don't transfer very well from air into the liquid-filled inner ear. So this means it's probable that the first land animals were deaf. There is evidence that the ability to hear seems to have evolved at least five times in frogs, turtles, lizards, mammals, dinosaurs, and birds, which came from dinosaurs. The basic solution is to develop an acoustic coupling that converts the sound waves in air to the sound waves in the inner ear fluid. The middle ear, which is the one that causes so much trouble in small children with ear infections, is thought to be a remnant of the fish's first gill, which might explain why it connects to the throat via the eustachian tube. But the middle ear is not the key structure. What matters is the stapes, which is a stirrup-shaped bone that conducts vibrations from the eardrum to the fluid in the inner ear, or the labyrinths of the cochlea. Now, he goes into a lot of detail about how hearing evolved, including the cochlea. The cochlea is important to hearing music and also is very important to other unique aspects of mammalian hearing. But why should I even talk about hearing? Well, he thinks that the hearing drove the evolution of the lowest part of the brain, the hind brain, which is the part closest to the spinal cord, and that it is important to understanding the structure of the brain. Where does the information from the ear go? He gives us a sort of simple way of looking at it. He's going to take the three special senses and talk about how they send their inputs into the three bulges. So we have hearing going to the hind brain, vision going to the midbrain, and smell going to the forebrain. Now, this is really an oversimplification, but it gives you a useful tool for getting a grasp of the basic structure of the brain. As the spinal cord is merging into the hindbrain, the basic structure remains about the same. The bottom part of the hindbrain is called the medulla, and at this level, many of the so-called cranial nerves start to come in. Cranial nerve 7 through 12, this includes the nerves that go to and from the tongue and the face, the eighth cranial nerve, vestibular cochlear nerve, which includes hearing and balance, cranial nerve 10, which is the vagus nerve, which is important because it carries signals to and from most of the internal organs, including the heart. As we start to move up the hindbrain, the gray matter becomes more scattered into so-called nuclei. The cochlear and vestibular nuclei are actually large enough to be seen as swellings. They connect up to another set of nuclei called the olives, which in turn connect to many other parts of the brain. The vestibular nuclei are wired to all the major motor areas of the brain, and they have direct connections back to the limb muscles via the spinal cord. And this is because they're so important for balance. Processing sound occurs in a string of nuclei that extend up the brainstem, and this includes encoding information into spatial and tonal maps. There are also taste nuclei in the hindbrain. Much of the structure of the hindbrain is still not very well understood, but we do know that there are nuclei for inducing vomiting and another one that detects acidity and makes you breathe faster in order to get rid of the excess acid. Much of the hindbrain is white matter, which is made up of the large tracts that are carrying information to and from the higher parts of the brain. In the front, we have the pyramids, which contain the major motor tracts. These are really big in people, which is thought to be related to the dexterity of humans. And in the back, there are the posterior columns, which carry sensory information. One sort of strange thing that happens at the level of the medulla is that the fibers from these tracts start to cross over or switch sides. This is called the decussation. Thus, at the level of the cerebral hemispheres, the left hemisphere senses and moves the right side of the body, and the right senses and moves the left. This crossing over at the decussation, I think, is mainly motor, because most of the sensory fibers actually cross over down in the spinal cord shortly after they enter the spinal cord. That's the reason why you can have an injury that causes a deficit where you have a sensory deficit on one side and a motor deficit on the opposite side. The hindbrain is relatively small. It contains the medulla and the pons, but it does a lot of important stuff. There are the cranial nerves, which we already talked about, and it has an essential role in controlling breathing. So if you get much damage to this area, you basically are dead. If you have an injury involving paralysis, it depends on whether it's above or below the decussation as to how much paralysis you will have. We're ready to move up to the next area, which is known as the midbrain. The midbrain receives inputs from the cranial nerves that are involved with the muscles of the eye and the second cranial nerve, which is the optic nerve. So before we talk about the midbrain, we're going to talk a little bit about the origins of the eye. Obviously, the eye didn't leave any fossil record, but we know a lot about how it forms in the embryo. Bainbridge describes the eye as, quote, a product of the brain, end quote. The eyes begin to form very early on in the embryo. As soon as the future brain has sealed into a tube, bulges start to protrude from each side. These eye stalks literally are part of the brain. And when this stalk gets near the surface of the embryo, it induces the formation of the eye plaque, which is what will eventually become the lens. Now, this eye plaque is different from the plaques that form all the other sense organs because it doesn't form any actual sensory cells. It becomes the lens, which was the last part of the vertebrate eye to evolve. The book contains some wonderful drawings that show how the folding of the eye stalk around the eye plaque incorporates the future lens into the eye. The retina is the part of the eye that contains the light-sensitive rods and cones. It develops from the eye stalk, which folds around the lens. So it is literally true to say that the retina is part of the brain, which is what I tell patients when I'm looking in their eyes with an ophthalmoscope. I'll tell them, I'm looking at the only part of the brain that we can see from the outside. Now, there's lots of neat stuff about the brain in this chapter, including a discussion about the way our eyes are different from those of other animals. Bainbridge observes that animals seem to fall into three main groups with respect to vision. About a third are totally blind, that is, they can detect no light at all. Another third have light-sensitive cells that can detect diffuse light coming in, and the final third can focus an image on a sheet of light-sensitive cells. Those who study brain evolution suspect that our ancestors detected light before they were able to focus. Again, I'll refer you back to the book for details, but there's a few highlights I want to mention. One is that light detection is surprisingly similar across species. It involves a molecule embedded in the detector that contains a smaller vitamin A-like light-sensitive molecule. The big molecule is called opsin, and the small molecule, the light-sensitive molecule, is called a chromophore. Bainbridge observes that this system is found in everything from single-celled organisms to the giant blue whale. Humans can make their own opsins, but we can't make chromophores, which is why we need vitamin A. Humans have four different opsins, and three of these are related to detecting different colors. The current evidence is that the photoreceptor evolved only once, but there are at least three different ways of arranging photoreceptors. But even when eyes appear to be very similar, they may actually be very different. An example he gives in the book is that between humans and octopi, In the octopus, the receptors point toward the light, but in humans, they actually face the back of the eye. This is one reason why biologists think that eye evolution occurred over 100 times in different realms of the animal kingdom. And that's pretty remarkable when you consider that the creationists and intelligent design types are still using the complexity of the eye as an argument against evolution. The argument that intermediate structures would not be useful fails in the face of actual examination. For example, clearly some light detection is better than none at all, and a lens that focuses imperfectly still offers an advantage over no focus at all. So in contrast to the creationist position, Bainbridge observes, quote, "Making eyes turns out to be the easiest, most natural thing in the world. In fact, it is now difficult to see why so many species with photoreceptors don't bother to evolve eyes." End quote. The same photoreceptor is seen from the single-cell organism up into the whale, but not everything has an eye. Many eyeless animals have the genetic code to form eyes, but it's not turned on. And this might have to do with the high energy demands of photoreceptors. You'd have to have a real strong need for vision in order for these to be worth the energy that they use. And that wouldn't be true. For example, if you lived in a place where it's totally dark, being able to see would be a total waste of energy. I've left out a lot of the interesting and weird properties about eyes, which he talks about, including how the retina seems to be built totally backwards. As he observes, this is something that no intelligent designer would countenance. He says that this is perfect evidence to show that the imperfect, illogical bodies that we have today are the results of millions and millions of years of blind historical accident. As I mentioned, the inputs from the eye come into the brain at the level of the midbrain, which is the top part of the brainstem. This is where we begin to observe a major principle about what the brain does with most of the sensory information it receives. Throws it away. And you might be surprised to learn that this process actually begins in the eye itself. Only the information from the center of the retina, the fovea, leaves the eye in its original form. Some fibers that are leaving the retina actually contain information accumulated from hundreds of photoreceptors. Why? It's not just to avoid information overload. It's so that the optic tracts can be a reasonable size. He says that if every photoreceptor had its own axon, the optic tract would be over an inch thick. Might make for an interesting alien. You may have heard that information from the right eye goes to the left side of the brain and vice versa. In all vertebrates, some of the optic fibers cross over to the opposite side before they enter the brain. In non-mammals, this is a complete process. In mammals, it's more complicated. In animals that have eyes on the sides of their heads, all the fibers cross. But in mammals whose eyes face forward, like humans, only half the fibers cross. The fibers from the outside of the retina don't cross. Now, I didn't mention that the image on the retina is reversed. So when this is combined with the crossing over, it means that the visual information from the right side of the body goes to the left side of the brain, and the images from the left side of the body go to the right side of the brain. So the key idea here is that it's not about which eye the information is coming from, but which side of the body it's coming from. In mammals, a lot of visual information heads for the forebrain, but there's still a significant input at the level of the midbrain. I will refer you again to his excellent description of what the midbrain does, but there's a few things I will briefly touch on. One is that the midbrain controls whether our pupils constrict. It also has a very primitive visual map that controls our ability to gaze at objects, and it controls the saccades, which are those little rapid eye movements that allow us to focus everything that we see onto the fovea so that the whole world looks sharp. The midbrain also controls our automatic responses to potential dangers, such as turning our heads toward things in our peripheral vision and ducking and closing our eyes when something comes at our head. There are actually dedicated fibers that go to the muscles of the neck. In this area of the midbrain, there's the hillock, which is part of the midbrain, which also maps sensory information, including sound and touch, and probably integrates them to some extent. This upper hillock part of the midbrain has been implicated in blind sight, which is when people show evidence of having some ability to see even when they have no conscious and when they are consciously blind. This brings us back to a theme we have considered before, the surprising importance of what happens at the unconscious level in our brain. We don't have any conscious access to the maps and functions of the midbrain, but it's absolutely essential to things we take for granted in our lives. Can you imagine if you had to figure out how to look at something? Now, the division between the conscious and unconscious visual pathways is not clear-cut. There seems to be interconnections, and we're learning more and more about how widespread visual processing is. For example, we know that the amygdala, which we'll discuss shortly, is essential for visual recognition of emotions, especially fear. The lowest part of the midbrain, which is called the tegmentum, seems to be largely devoted to motor function. This is where there are the cranial nerves, such as 3 and 4, that control eye movements, and also cranial nerve 2 that carries the visual information from the retina. Another important structure in the midbrain is the reticular formation, which is important to arousal. Bainbridge includes in his discussion of the midbrain a nuclei known as the substantia nigra, which is important in Parkinson's disease. It contains dopaminergic neurons. And when we have Parkinson's disease, we lose our smooth, coordinated motor activity. Usually I have read of the substantia nigra as being part of the basal ganglia, which is one of the deepest structures of the forebrain. I think that just demonstrates the fact that the division of the parts is somewhat arbitrary, especially at this level as they are gradually transitioning from one to the next. The Brain Science Podcast is sponsored by Audible.com, the world's leading provider of downloadable audio content, including books from a wide variety of genres. Beyond the Zonules of Zen is not available, so I'm going to suggest the book Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind by David J. Linden. Touch explores scientific advances in the understanding of touch that help explain our sense of self and our experience of the world. If you aren't already an Audible member, you can get this as a free download by going to audiblepodcast.com/brainscience. Now we are about ready to talk about the forebrain, and this brings us to our third special sense, which is smell. Smell is unique because it's the only sense that plugs directly into the forebrain, and even though our sense of smell is weak compared to most other animals, the fact that it still connects directly to the forebrain explains why smells can have such a powerful effect on our emotions and our behavior. Bainbridge talks a little bit about how smell probably evolved. 5% of the genes in mammals are devoted to smell receptors. We have the same number of genes for this as mice, but about 60% of our genes are either degenerate or inactive. Vertebrates all seem to have the same basic smell plan, but invertebrates are different. Unlike vision, there doesn't seem to be a universal system for smell detection. This suggests that smell happened after vertebrates broke off from invertebrates, which makes it a more recent acquisition. Just a little bit more about smell. We know that our smell receptors can adapt to ambient smells so well that we can no longer smell them. The discovery of how smell works is actually fairly recent. The 2004 Nobel Prize in Medicine and Physiology went to Linda Buck and Richard Axel for their discovery of odorant receptor proteins and the organization of the olfactory system. We have about 10 million smell cells, and each one of these has about 1,000 different receptors, and other species may have even more receptors than we do and more smell cells. So it starts to make sense that some of us are genetically unable to smell certain things as we just aren't coding for the receptors. Smell goes to many different places in the brain. In fact, he observes smell pervades our brain in the way the other senses do not. Now we're going to talk about the forebrain. First, we have to consider how the transition into the forebrain occurs. We've had this canal that contains the cerebrospinal fluid that goes all the way down into the spinal cord. When we get to this level, it starts to open up and form what's called the third ventricle. And the walls of the third ventricle form what he calls the interbrain, which is the transition between the brainstem and the forebrain. The walls of the third ventricle contain two important structures, the thalamus and the hypothalamus. We tend to refer to these organs as if they were single structures, but there's actually one on each side. So there's actually two thalami and two hypothalami. So this is at the level where things are starting to become, as he calls it, more brainy and less spinal. Hypo just means under, so that tells us that the thalamus lies above the hypothalamus. And then on the roof of this third ventricle, or the epithalamus, there is the infamous pineal gland. You may remember that the pineal gland was what Descartes thought was the place where the non-physical mind would be communicating with the brain. And this turns out to be extremely wrong because in people, the pineal gland gets only a very tiny bit of visual information, basically light sensation. And it makes melatonin at night, which is important to sleep. But that's about all it seems to do in people. In the same area, there's something called the habenula, which is part of the reward system of the brain and gets a lot of smell inputs. And the habenula connects to something a little bit lower down called the interpeduncular nucleus of Gudin via the vesiculus retroflexus. I only mention this bunch of gobbledygook because the vesiculus retroflexus has been observed to be degenerated in some cases of addiction. And you know that this whole idea of addiction and its involvement with the reward system of the brain is a very hot area of research right now. The thalamus are the major structure in the inner brain. They are a very important component of the sensory system. Everything except for smell is relayed to the cortex via the thalamus. Traditionally, it was thought the thalamus was just a relay system, but we now know it does much more than that. A lot of sensory processing and interpretation is actually going on at the level of the thalamus. This has been best studied for vision because the lateral geniculate nuclei, LGN, has been greatly studied. That's the main input place where the optic nerve comes into the lateral geniculate nucleus, and then it sends its information to the primary visual cortex. There's been traditionally thought that there was two major pathways that were parallel, a what and a where, but this is kind of becoming a little bit controversial about whether other information might actually be separated out, such as color information or time information. Exactly how much of this is really being separated out at the level of the thalamus is still a subject of debate. But again, remember that the smell information has gone straight to the cortex, so it skipped the thalamus, even though smell information is going to come back down to the thalamus. Below that, there's the hypothalamus, which is sometimes thought of as the body's thermostat because it's the master controller of most of our visceral functions like body temperature, appetite, aggression, and sex. When somebody talks about their body weight set point or something like that, they're referring to functions attributed to the hypothalamus. It's a very primal structure. It may be one of the oldest parts of the brain because every vertebrate has one. It gets inputs from almost every other part of the brain and the body, and it sends out signals in two ways. One, by sending signals to other parts of the nervous system, such as telling us that we need to get out of the cold, for example. But it also sends out hormones. It does this via the pituitary gland, which is something that also all vertebrates have. Pituitary gland kind of hangs down from the brain. It has two parts, a kind of brainy part and a glandular part. The back part, called the posterior pituitary, is really essentially part of the brain. It releases ADH, which controls water metabolism, and oxytocin, which is involved in birth contractions, milk secretion, and orgasm, and recently has been discovered to have some other important roles too. ADH and oxytocin are actually being synthesized in the hypothalamus, but they are released by the pituitary. In contrast, the other hormones that come from the more glandular part of the pituitary are actually made in the pituitary, and these are the hormones that control the thyroid, the adrenal glands, metabolism and growth, and sex hormones. This includes things like thyroid stimulating hormone, growth hormone, prolactin, and follicle stimulating hormone. So here's an example of how it works. The hypothalamus will release thyroid releasing hormone, and it sends this to the pituitary gland to tell it to release thyroid stimulating hormone, which in turn tells the thyroid to make and release thyroid hormone. When you read a description about hormones, usually the releasing hormones are the ones that are coming from the hypothalamus. The stimulating hormones are coming from the pituitary, and the actual hormone is coming from the endocrine gland, such as the adrenal, the thyroid, or the sex organs. We're almost ready to get up to the real forebrain, which he also calls the end brain, because basically you have two end brains that are growing out of the side of the forebrain that then wrap around the rest of the brain in the end. So what about the cerebral hemispheres makes them different from the rest of the nervous system? Now we find that the gray matter or the cell bodies is on the outside, and we have a cortex that's basically a thin, continuous sheet of gray matter. This is in contrast to the lower parts of the brain, where we have the scattered nuclei, and then, of course, in the spinal cord, where all the gray matter is on the inside. Gone from gray matter on the inside, gray matter scattered, to gray matter spread around the outside. There's also a unique columnar organization for the cerebral cortex, but he doesn't really talk about that in this book. He has a good brief description comparing the evolution of the forebrain among the different land vertebrates, reptiles, birds, and mammals. And while the cerebral cortex is unique to mammals, the reptiles and birds have brain structures that seem to share similar functions in that they get diverse inputs from throughout the nervous system. In reptiles, this is called the dorsal ventricular ridge, and in birds, it's called the avian wurst. And especially in birds, we're learning that at least some kinds of birds can be a lot more intelligent than was once thought. He points out that there's nothing inherently modern about our mammalian cortex. So calling it the neocortex is a little bit of a misnomer. The supposedly mammalian tendency to concentrate higher processing in the forebrain is actually a general vertebrate trait. All living vertebrates use their forebrain to varying extents to integrate sensation and action. Now, this tendency might be limited in most vertebrates, whereas in mammals, it becomes quite prominent. The forebrain houses both the smell and higher centers, but in humans, the processes of the cortex that aren't related to smell tend to overshadow the smell function. Looking at the features of the mammalian cortex, one thing is that there are six layers in the cortex, and that's unique. The dendrites and the axons are short and stubby because they're communicating mostly with each other or nearby neurons, and they're called pyramidal because of the shape of the cell body. This might be a feature that helps them to be better at collating inputs. Why is the surface so wrinkly? It seems that this is a way of increasing surface area. Think about scrunching up a piece of paper to get it to take up less space. The basic structure of the cerebral hemispheres is very similar from person to person. We have the gyri and sulci, the bumps and the grooves. The big groove that everyone has is called the fissure of Rolando, and that's roughly separating the sensory parts of the brain, which are in the back, with the motor parts that are in the front. The primary motor area and the primary sensory area are found right on either side of this groove. However, we now know that this is very much an oversimplification. since many parts of the brain are turning out to have a mixture of motor and sensory neurons. Of course, we usually divide each hemisphere into four lobes, the occipital lobe in the back, the temporal lobe on the side, the parietal lobe on the top, and the frontal lobe in the front. I have to mention a few other structures at this sort of end of the brain. There's the cerebellum, kind of on the back and bottom of the brain, and it is very important in coordinating motor activities. It's even more wrinkly than the cerebral hemispheres and has a very dense concentration, the densest concentration of neurons in the brain. And then buried very deep in the forebrain is, as I mentioned before, the basal ganglia. This includes the substantia nigra, the subthalamic nucleus, striatum, the putamen, the caudate, and the nucleus accumbens. Now, there's a lot of debate about whether or not these really should all be lumped together. What they seem to have in common is that they are areas of gray matter located in the white matter of the cerebral hemisphere. These are the parts that have a structure more like the lower parts of the brain instead of the six-layer structure of the cortex proper. I guess I should mention how the two cerebral hemispheres communicate with each other, because they are actually remarkably separate for the most part. But there's a large connection that you can see with your naked eye called the corpus callosum, which actually only placental mammals have. And then there's several different smaller connections that are called commissures. Finally, before we conclude this very brief whirlwind tour of the brain, there are a few more parts of the cerebral hemispheres that we need to talk about that are a little bit different from the cortex proper. These are parts that are shared by all vertebrates, and that's why they're sometimes called the old cortex, but they don't have that six-layer structure. Recent research indicates that the emphasis shouldn't be on which structure's the oldest, because all vertebrates seem to share the same basic forebrain structure, with different regions being emphasized in different groups. What I'm talking about here is which ones are emphasized in these structures that are deep down in the inner surfaces of the hemispheres. They have varying importance in different animals. It's not that they are particularly old, it's just that they're easy to find in many different types of vertebrate. And so there's a lot of debate about what to call this area. A medial temporal lobe might be the most accurate anatomical description, although you usually hear it referred to as the limbic system, which is misleading mostly because it tends to lump things together that don't necessarily belong lumped together. There's a nice diagram in the book that shows how these parts of the brain got to have the shape that they have now, which is kind of loopy looking. From the top of the brain down on the inside of the temporal lobe, we have the cingulate gyrus, the amygdala, and the hippocampus. Some of this is what we were traditionally told was the limbic system, and we were traditionally told that this was our emotional brain, but we now know that it's a little bit more complicated than that. Even so, we do know that the amygdala is a very important area for processing emotional information, especially fear. A lot of times when you read about the limbic system in the older literature, they may actually be describing amygdala function, although it's not that easy to isolate out what the amygdala does by itself, because to have an isolated injury to the amygdala is very rare. However, the amygdala is clearly different from the hippocampus, which is, as we've talked about several times in the past, very important for forming long-term memory and also for our spatial awareness. We have talked about memory quite a bit, and I refer you back to episodes 3 and episodes 12 if you're new to the Brain Science Podcast. Now, with regards to the cingulate gyrus, it's a little bit unclear when he talks about this in the book whether he's talking about a specific surface of the cortex or whether he's talking about the anterior cingulate cortex, which we now know contains mirror neurons. I would think at this point it's fair to say that our understanding of this area is fairly limited. And then another thing he doesn't mention at all is the insula, which communicates with some of these structures. The insula is actually located on the medial or inside surface of the parietal lobe. Recent research has indicated that it's involved in the reward system and in addiction. So this has been a pretty long episode to describe the parts of the brain. I talked a little bit about the origins of hearing, sight, and smell. It's kind of surprising to find out that there's only one kind of photoreceptor, but that eyes appear to have evolved quite a number of times. Hearing seems to, although it has arisen several times, be basically based on a pretty similar pattern from animal to animal. And smell seems in some ways to be the newest of the senses in that it is different between vertebrates and invertebrates. The basic pattern that we can remember is that if we start at the spinal cord, at the level of the spinal cord, the neurons are on the inside and the axons are on the outside. As we move up into the brainstem, the neurons begin to be clustered into nuclei, scattered among the white matter of axons. And at the level of the brainstem, most of the cranial nerves come in. As we move up into the actual, what we normally think of as the actual brain, the structure gradually changes again. We have at the lower parts of the brain still scattered nuclei that communicate with each other, until finally we reach the level of the cortex, where now all the gray matter is on the outside with the neurons in a sheet on the surface of the brain with a six-layer structure and a columnar organization that seems to be organized to promote the special extreme interconnection that occurs at the level of the cortex compared to the rest of the brain. Beyond the Zonules of Zen, A Fantastic Journey Through Your Brain, by David Bainbridge, is a book that I can recommend to listeners of all backgrounds. If you've ever studied anatomy, this is a great review. And if you have never looked at the brain at all, this will be a wonderful introduction.
Before I give a brief summary of today's episode, I want to remind you that I will be speaking in Denver, Colorado on May 8th, 2015, as part of the 74th annual meeting of the American Humanist Association. If you will be in Denver anytime between May 7th through the 10th, and you would like to get together, please drop me an email at brainsciencepodcast@gmail.com. What I like about Beyond the Zonules of Zen, A Fantastic Journey Through Your Brain, by David Bainbridge, is that while it emphasizes how much our brains are similar to those of other vertebrates, it also highlights how we are different. He starts at the level of the spinal cord, where the neurons are on the inside and the white matter tracts that carry information to and from the brain are on the outside. This structure makes intuitive sense, since the nerves have to come off the spinal cord at various levels along the way. If you want to learn a little bit more about this, I recommend episode 110, which is an interview with Frank Amthor, author of Neurobiology for Dummies. We are learning that the spinal cord is actually a very sophisticated structure, and in vertebrates with simpler brains, it does some pretty amazing things. As we move up the spinal cord, at the top, there are three major divisions: hindbrain, midbrain, and forebrain. The hindbrain consists of the medulla and the pons. Several important cranial nerves come in here, including the nerves that contain auditory or hearing information. The medulla is also essential to basic functions like heartbeat and breathing. Then we move up to the midbrain. Together with the midbrain, these structures are called the brainstem. That is to say, the hindbrain and midbrain together, or the medulla, pons, and midbrain, make up the brainstem, because they're located at the bottom of the brain where it connects to the spinal cord. Several cranial nerves come in at the level of the midbrain. These control the muscles of the eye and also the cranial nerve 2, which is the optic nerve, which contains visual information that's on its way to the thalamus. At the level of the hindbrain and midbrain, the neurons are scattered in groups that are called nuclei. Finally, we come to the forebrain, but on the inside, we still have scattered groups of neurons or nuclei, which represent a more primitive structure than the outer layers of gray matter, which form the cerebral cortex with its unique columnar structure. The columnar structure is thought to be vital to the incredible interconnectedness of the cortex. During the episode, I mentioned that smell is the only sense that goes straight to the forebrain. If you want to learn more about smell, I recommend episode 34 with Rachel Hertz, the author of The Scent of Desire, Discovering Our Enigmatic Sense of Smell. One of the things I really like about the Zonules of Zen is the discussion of the evolution of hearing, vision, and smell. So finally, we come to the forebrain, which actually has several parts to it. The diencephalon, which he also calls the interbrain, I think that's the way I referred to it, contains the thalamus and the hypothalamus. And then moving on up to the telencephalon, we have the cerebral cortex, basal ganglia, and amygdala. The basal ganglia, the amygdala, and the thalamus and the hypothalamus are all midline structures that continue to have the primitive nuclei type structure. Usually if you hear the phrase subcortical, the strict anatomical use of this phrase refers to the basal ganglia and the amygdala. But some authors will also include the cerebellum as a subcortical structure. Usually when I use the term subcortical, I'm thinking of all the parts of the brain below the level of the cortex. Neuroanatomy is a very challenging subject to discuss on an audio podcast, and I've obviously only scratched the surface. But I hope you get a sense of how the basic structure is a key to understanding how it works. I've included several references in the show notes for those of you who want to learn more, and I would love to hear your feedback. Would you like to hear more about the anatomy of the brain? And if so, what structures would you like me to include? If you have any specific questions, I will try to address these on a future show. Just write to me at brainsciencepodcast@gmail.com. Next month, I hope to interview Dr. Ed Taub about constraint-induced movement therapy, which is his pioneering technique that uses brain plasticity to treat a wide variety of brain injuries, ranging from stroke to traumatic brain injury. I will be finishing my fellowship in palliative medicine at the end of June, and I hope that after that I will be able to get into some more new topics and books, including a follow-up episode about the role of glial cells. I want to take a moment to thank those of you who support my work in various ways, through donations and especially through the premium subscription, which was launched in January of 2014. For those of you who are new listeners, the most 25 recent episodes of the Brain Science Podcast are always free, but premium subscribers have unlimited access to over 100 older episodes, plus the transcript for every episode. The subscription only costs $5 a month, and you can cancel at any time, which means you could subscribe for 1 month, download everything, and then cancel your subscription. Naturally, I hope you won't want to do this, since the subscription is a very convenient way to support my work. One question I often get from new subscribers is how to get the premium content into iTunes. Unfortunately, there is no way to make this happen automatically. The same is true for any other podcasting app you might be using. That's why if you're listening on a smartphone, I recommend the free mobile app, since once you log in, it will show all the episodes and the transcripts. If you are listening on your desktop, you can either stream the episodes from the premium website or download each episode and then drag it into iTunes or wherever you want to save it. If you use an iPod, you'll want to create a playlist of these downloaded episodes and then sync that playlist to your iPod. One other benefit of the mobile app is that I often include premium content in the episode extras. For this episode, I plan to include episode 34, which is the episode about smell. Also, don't forget, when you're on the website at brainsciencepodcast.com and you're checking out our social links and everything, to be sure to sign up for the Brain Science Podcast newsletter. That way you can get show notes automatically and you will never miss a new episode. And don't forget that if you're going to be in Denver between May 7th and 10th, to reach out to me, because I love to meet new listeners whenever I travel. Finally, I want to remind you that since I do not advertise this show, your word of mouth is very important. Reviews in iTunes or on the App Store help immensely, as does posting links in your blog or wherever else you hang out. I don't have much time to interact with Facebook, Twitter, or Google+, so I really appreciate those of you who help me out there, too. Thanks again for listening. I look forward to talking with you again very soon. The Brain Science Podcast is copyright 2015, Virginia Campbell, MD. You can copy this podcast to share it with others, but for any other uses or derivatives, please contact me at brainsciencepodcast@gmail.com. The new theme music for the Brain Science Podcast is Mindfire by Tony Catraccia. You can find his work at syncopationnow.com.